This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
Also, an often untold story of Black History Month, co-sponsored by KPFT 90.1, KUHT Houston PBS, Mercy Community Center, U of H Urban Experience Program, and the Houston UPF Pioneers Club. Admission is free, but seating is limited. For more information and to RSVP, visit princehouston.org. This is KPFT Houston.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
Impossibly,
somebody else.
We jumped the gun there. This is Deborah Bell.
And Jennifer Renee.
And I'm Glenn Holt.
And I'm Brian Levinka.
Yeah, it takes a certain finite amount of time to get set up from one show to the next. On tonight's show, lesbian affairs. Are they different? Well, I don't mean that kind of an affair. I mean, we'll be having a discussion of lesbian lives and activities by the women who are involved in them. And this is scary. There's a new kind of antibiotic-resistant bacteria spreading in the gay community. Like the early days of the AIDS crisis, the focus seems to be New York, Chicago, and San Francisco again. And again, the victims are sexually active gay men. What's going on? Brian and I will find out from a specialist at the Center for AIDS. Love, Janice. That's the name of a play being presented this Thursday evening by the Alley Theater. It's about rock star Janis Joplin, and it's a benefit for Assist Hers. We'll hear more about it from both of those organizations. And, of course, our syndicated features from This Way Out, starting off with News Wrap.
And I guess we'll go to News Wrap in just a minute, talking about some of the stuff that's coming up this week. What is coming up this week? I know we've all been busy with believe it or not, the upcoming election. It's certainly been interesting with the elections. And David Elliott was wrong with his prediction.
I know. Gee. Of course. You know, I'm a Hillary supporter.
Well, I'm a supporter of change.
Yes. They're all supporters of change, and they all want it to be a better world. Who's going to be against that?
I like the idea that there's just an outside chance that after all said and done, after Super Tuesday or Super Duper Tuesday, as they want to call it, the media calls it, that Texas will decide after all.
We'll have a thing. I have this wonderful little thing on my computer that counts down the days. 364 days, 14 hours, 56 minutes, and 48 seconds.
Until Bush is out?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, yes.
Well, we can hardly wait.
We can hardly wait on that one.
And, of course, we're also gearing up to pay more attention to the local races.
That's a very good point, Deborah, because as you watch all this national media, that's all they're talking about. And there are so many very important local races all around the country. And certainly here in Houston, we're working on that at the caucus.
And what source would we want to go to know who to vote for?
Well, we're not quite there yet because the endorsement meeting hasn't happened yet. But
and that would be the caucus?
The caucus.org will give you information on people who the caucus thinks would make some very good representatives.
People that have gone through the screening process and gotten the endorsement of the Houston Gay, Lesbian, Bisexual, and Transgendered Political Caucus.
Yes, and it's sort of exciting. We have some gay men running for judges.
Ooh.
Yes.
Well, how about that?
Where are the Democrats?
That's the other thing that's kind of exciting about it, because we have so few Democratic judges in Harris County.
Yeah, but where are the lesbian judges?
Yeah, well, we've got the lesbians covering city council.
Okay.
By the way, we also have a segment coming up tonight with Jennifer. I don't think Glenn mentioned it.
No, Glenn didn't. Josue Mimi, who is a counselor, a couples counselor, and a professional in dealing with parenting. I've known Josue for about 6 or 7 months, and it's just fascinating some of the things you can talk about to look at, not only with same-sex parenting or same-sex relationships, it has its own unique portion, but parenting comes out to be the same no matter what, whether you're same-sex or heterosexual.
And as you and I know, as parents. And so we'll go to This Way Out, and then we'll be back with the rest of the show.
I'm Rick Watts.
And I'm Sherry Lund.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending January 19, 2008. 3 men in Cameroon have been sentenced to 6 months in prison at hard labor for being gay. They've been in jail since their arrests in the port city of Douala on August 31st, when police officers were randomly searching for armed robbers. One of the men confessed to being gay after being beaten at the police station and implicated his 2 friends. According to Joel Nana of the International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission, or IGLHRC, as soon as the shadow of homosexuality enters into a case, due process goes out the window. Article 347 of the West African country's penal code punishes consensual same-sex relationships with up to 3 years in jail. But the men's lawyer, Alison Combe, told reporters that she would appeal the convictions because none of them were found guilty of committing homosexual acts, and the court cannot condemn them for something they never did. More than 30 people have been jailed in Cameroon in the last 2 years on charges of homosexuality, despite an October 2006 ruling by the United Nations Working Group on Arbitrary Detention that such arrests violate the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. The country's national LGBT rights group, Alternatives Cameroon, has been joined by Amnesty International, IGLHRC, and other human rights organizations in calling for the repeal of Article 347, the release of all people detained under that law, and an end to official discrimination based on sexual orientation in that country.
The North African country of Morocco is also a signatory to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, but an appeals court there this week upheld the December convictions of 6 men who were charged with lewd and unnatural acts for taking part in what the local press called a gay wedding. The men, who range in age from 20 to 61 years old, had appeared in a widely circulated online video, including on the popular YouTube site, that authorities said also showed a man in a dress dancing at the party. Homosexual acts in Morocco are punishable by up to 3 years in prison. Western human rights groups who monitored the original proceedings said that no evidence was offered that any of the 6 men, who each pleaded not guilty, had actually engaged in such illegal acts. The man described as the organizer, who was also convicted of serving liquor illegally, was sentenced to 10 months behind bars. The others received 6-month sentences. The appeals court did reduce the prison sentences for all but the organizer to 4 months. Philip Luther, deputy director for the Middle East and North Africa program at Amnesty International, called the men's convictions a travesty and demanded their immediate release. He said his group is also concerned about their personal safety after that happens. The public controversy sparked by this case in Morocco, he said, begs for an urgent review of the country's discriminatory laws which criminalize homosexuality.
A South Korean riot policeman has come out on a police community website, raising new questions about the treatment of lesbi-gay service personnel in the country. Using a pseudonym, Private Kim Hyun-jong wrote that coming out was difficult, but that it was an important issue for the South Korean military. Kim, who works at a police station in Seoul, told the Korea Times that his announcement was not well received by his colleagues, and that, "I heard many talking behind my back describing me as a dirty gay man." All South Korean men are required to serve in the military or in the riot police for up to 2 years. Same-gender sexual activity is a serious offense under the country's military codes, and gay men have been regularly sent to mental institutions. Several men have been kicked out of South Korea's military for homosexuality in recent years, and in 2006, a soldier who had attempted suicide claimed that he was ordered to submit photographs of himself in bed with another man, and forced to take an HIV test after he came out to superiors. While there are no references to homosexuality in the South Korean Constitution or Civil Penal Code, anti-queer discrimination is fairly common in the conservative country, which is dominated by strict Confucian tradition and strongly influenced by the Roman Catholic Church.
Meanwhile, U.S. Army Sergeant Darren Manzella, who came out on the CBS TV program 60 Minutes last month, complete with a video of himself and a former boyfriend kissing, is still on active duty. Manzella worried that would get him kicked out of the military under the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, which says lesbian gay members can serve only if they keep their sexual orientation a secret. I thought I would at least be asked about the segment, he told the newspaper USA Today, or approached and told I shouldn't speak to the media again. But, he says, that hasn't happened. His case apparently is not unusual. The U.S. military queer advocacy group Service Members Legal Defense Network says there are now a record number of openly lesbi-gay members of the military, at least 500 that the organization knows about. Discharges under Don't Ask, Don't Tell have fallen sharply since the United States invaded Iraq in 2003.
In other U.S. news, the City Council of Cambridge, Massachusetts voted unanimously this week to elect the nation's first black openly lesbian mayor. Denise Simmons, a member of the council since 2001, will succeed Ken Reeves, who had been the country's first black openly gay mayor. With a population of about 100,000 and located on the outskirts of Boston, Cambridge is home to both Harvard University and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. The city's perhaps more famous namesake in England made history of its own last year when its councillors chose a transgender woman as mayor.
U.S. Republican Senator Larry Craig of Idaho, who was arrested last June for allegedly seeking sex with an undercover cop in a Minneapolis airport men's room, has presented some new legal arguments in his quest to have his disorderly conduct guilty plea reversed by the Minnesota Court of Appeals. He originally admitted to the lesser offense to avoid being slapped with a more serious lewd conduct charge. In a brief filed last week, Craig's lawyers argued that Minnesota's disorderly conduct statute requires that others be offended by the defendant's actions, and in Craig's case, only one other person was involved, undercover cop Sergeant Dave Karsnia. Craig's attorneys also claim that Karsnia couldn't have been upset by Craig's actions, which allegedly included peering through a crack into Karsnia's stall, tapping his foot invitingly and repeatedly sliding his hand under the stall divider, moves well known among bathroom cruisers, because Karsnia was tapping his own foot enticingly. Craig, who's voted against every piece of legislation that would advance LGBT equality, continues to insist that he isn't gay or bisexual, even after the Idaho Statesman newspaper published the stories of 8 men who claim they had sex with him or experienced sexual come-ons from him. And in what several pundits have described as a case of strange bedfellows, the American Civil Liberties Union defended Craig in a court filing this week, citing a 38-year-old Minnesota Supreme Court ruling that people who have sex in closed stalls and public restrooms have a reasonable expectation of privacy, and that his alleged actions were therefore not illegal. The government cannot prove beyond a reasonable doubt, the ACLU wrote in its brief, that Senator Craig was inviting the undercover officer to engage in anything other than sexual intimacy that would not have called attention to itself in a closed stall in the public restroom. Craig initially said he would resign following the revelations of his disorderly conduct guilty plea, but has since vowed to fight to overturn the conviction and finish his term, which ends in January 2009.
And finally, at least from the perspective of LGBT civil rights advocates and their supporters, Baptist minister and former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee, who's seeking the Republican presidential nomination, may be the scariest of all the GOP contenders. Huckabee, who won the Iowa Republican caucus vote and is giving Mitt Romney, John McCain, and others a run for their money, told a TV interviewer in December that people who are gay say they're born that way. We may have certain tendencies, but how we behave and how we carry out our behavior is a choice. In an interview this week with BeliefNet, an online religious site, Huckabee said he wanted to outlaw abortion and compared same-gender marriage to bestiality. I don't think that's a radical view to say that we're going to affirm marriage, he said. I think the radical view is to say that we're going to change the definition of marriage so that it can mean two men, two women, a man and three women, a man and a child, a man and an animal. And speaking at a campaign rally in Michigan on January 14th, Huckabee told supporters that,
I have opponents in this race who do not want to change the Constitution. But I believe it's a lot easier to change the Constitution than it would be to change the Word of the living God. And that's what we need to do, is to amend the Constitution so it's in God's standards, rather than try to change God's standards so it lines up with some contemporary view of how we treat each other and how we treat the family.
Even the lesbi-gay log cabin Republicans have condemned Huckabee's remarks. In a statement this week, its president, Patrick Salmon, criticized the governor's pattern of ill-informed and extreme statements. Governor Huckabee should remember it's 2008, not 1968, and he's running for president, not preacher.
That's NewsWrap for the week ending January 19th, 2008. Written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Rick Watts.
And I'm Sherry Lund.
Girlfriend, girlfriend, look at you, looking fine, just like brand new. Girlfriend, I see something's changed. Girlfriend, my friend, your life had been all about a world called men. Now that's all been rearranged. But love came in and you came out. Love walked through the fear and doubt and opened up your heart to something. Her big brown eyes turned you around, and now girlfriend's world turned upside down. Cause love came out, and girlfriend, so did you. Well, girlfriend, my friend, you were scared by feelings that your new friend shared. So you prayed to God's girl Mary for a sign. Well, sweet Suzanne, your answer came, and now Mary is your girlfriend's name. Now life will never ever be the same. Love came in, you came out. I walked through the fear and doubt and opened up your heart to something new. Her big brown eyes turned you around, and now girlfriend's world turned upside down. Love came out, and girlfriend, so did you. Love ignores the rules that love had played before. Tell my girlfriend, what's a girl to do? Well, hold on tight with all your might, and know that through rough days and nights, that this friend's love is gonna pull you through.
That was Matthew Cloran. Love came in and you came out. This is Queer Voices.
Well, even though that wasn't sung by women, it still has the same message about, you know, love comes in and we come out. This is a new segment of Lesbian Voices. I hope it to be a continuing series on the third Monday of every month, where we talk about lesbian affairs. And, oh no, not those kind of affairs. Well, maybe a little bit. But I have Aja and Tia with me, and we're going to talk about some issues that we face in our lives as lesbians. And some of this will be everything from age differences in relationships to, Aja's kind of like giggling there, what if you get involved with a trans person? What if you're bisexual? All kinds of things that we don't really get to talk a lot about on Queer Voices. We don't really we try to have a diversity, but we don't necessarily make it be male, female, or how we mix it up. It can come about through our guests, but we also want to make sure that we start having more women participate in the show. And so that's one reason for this segment. And if you should be interested and have something to say about women in the lesbian community, and you are a lesbian and therefore qualified to talk on the subject, then contact me at Deborah@queervoices.org, and we'll talk about maybe a specific issue or idea that you would like to see discussed. So, Aja, what's up?
Wow, where should I start? Where would you like me to start, Deborah?
Well, you know, we had talked about some of the different things in our community, and you had mentioned that you had some ideas about some things that should be discussed, and you thought maybe Tia would also have some comments on that. For one thing, you're young women.
Yes.
I came out at the age of 33, married with two kids, so my experience is very different. Yours is different than mine. Hers is different than yours. So let's talk a little bit about how you came out after that love came in and you came out.
Well, I started coming out when I was about 11. I knew very early I had crushes on my female teachers, and it's like, ooh, I like girls, I'm not really into guys, you know. And I just sort of started telling my friends and everything, and I guess I sort of officially came out when I was about 15 or so, and I told my grandmother, who is one of the most important people in my life, I told friends and everything, but I wrote her a letter. I wrote her a letter, and later on I came home, and she says, oh, you know, this phase you're going through, and just be safe and everything. And she wasn't as supportive as I would have liked, but she did say, you know, I love you, and just stay, be safe.
Well, weren't you in a small town in East Texas?
Oh, no, by that time, I was in Houston.
Oh.
So, yeah.
So, how, I mean, you just thought, oh, okay, that's it, I'm a lesbian. Or was there any trepidation or bad reactions from people?
Lots of fear. Not that many bad reactions, actually. My generation is so much more accepting. And living in the city, you find much more acceptance. But mostly it's from guys trying to ask me out, or just people saying, well, you never been with a guy. How do you know? How do you know? And it's the fact that I never really wanted to be with a guy. I couldn't see that for myself. I always just wanted a woman, saw myself with a woman. And there was lots of fear.
You asked them, had they been with a guy? Maybe they should try it. Maybe, you know, how do they know?
My girlfriend always says that. Tell guys, you know, have you ever been with a man? Maybe you should try it. But I mostly received acceptance. People didn't understand. They thought, oh, you're so young, you'll grow out of it. But I never grew out of it. So that's pretty much my story.
Uh-huh. And Tia, how about you? You mentioned earlier when we were talking that you grew up in a church environment.
Yes, I grew up in the church with my grandmother. I was raised in between my grandmother and my mother, and I pretty much was in the church, and just that's all I had known. So when I was coming out and figuring things out, I had a lot of questions and a lot of issues with that. It took me a lot of searching and a few years struggling with it and everything else before I actually did come out. And I came out to friends first and then family, which was the hardest. And I did the same thing as Aja did. I ended up writing a letter to my grandmother. So I was like, I went up there and handed her a letter, and then I got home and then I called her.
And how did she react?
It was one of those things where I love you, but I'm still praying for this man and still, you know, hope that, you know, all this other stuff. So it was this kind of half acceptance. She's gotten a lot better, though.
I don't quite know why it is that mothers and grandmothers somehow think that having a man fixes everything, even when that hasn't been their own experience. You know?
Who knows?
And my mother also, it's like she knows, but she just can't really accept it. And so we basically don't talk about it.
Yeah.
But my when I was partnered before, my partner went with me to my home with my parents. You know, it's like someone said that I chose my father's funeral as my coming out party. And I said, if they think that I'm just now coming out, they haven't been paying attention. It's like, hello, where have you been? I've been, you know, since I came out, I've been pretty much part of the, well, before I even came out, I was active in the GLBT community, and an advocate as a feminist. So, it, for me, it was a kind of a natural course. It really didn't feel like, oh, it's a bad thing or it's a scary thing. I knew a lot of lesbians. It just felt kind of a natural thing. The problem was, of course, that I was married and had children. And I think something like more than 50% of lesbians do have children, whether from traditional marriage or partnering with someone and deciding to have children by insemination or by adoption. Later in the show, Jennifer Renee is going to be talking with a counselor about couples and parenting issues. And that certainly is a big aspect of our community, since there are so many women that have children. And how do you get involved in a relationship and there's this child, and you have to consider that you're also going to have a relationship with that child, and what will it mean? You have any other ideas about being a young lesbian and an activist in Houston?
There's really not much to say. There's a lot of support in the community. You just honestly have to find it.
How did you go about finding it?
I started with Hatch when I was about 15, 16.
Tell people what Hatch is.
Hatch, it's basically a support group for GLBTQ youth, ages 13 to 20, and it's not a place where they try to convert you. It's honestly just sort of a support youth group. They give you lots of information and, you know, just sort of help you try and find your way.
Mm-hmm. And it's now run as a program through the Montrose Counseling Center. So if people want more information about that, they can call 713-529-0037 and ask about Hatch, which is the program. It used to be called Houston Area Teen Coalition of Homosexuals or for Homosexuals, and then they just said, oh, that's silly to have a name like that. And so they just call it Hatch.
Yeah.
And sometimes they call the young people hatchlings. Yes.
Chicky.
And so you were young then, so Hatch has been around a while
Hatch
now.
Hatch has been around now.
It's past its 10 years.
Yeah. Wow, now I feel old.
Well, nothing's wrong with old. But that's really interesting that you had, I mean, so many of us, we would have just been thrilled to have had something available in the community, a safe environment with which to understand ourselves better and to meet other GLBT and Q, which is questioning youth.
And allies. Allies come too.
That's
allies
right.
Are more than
that's
welcome.
Very important.
Oh, yeah.
And how about you, Tia? Did you find support?
It took me a while. I actually started going to PFLAG, mm-hmm. and from there I heard about the church that I go to.
And PFLAG is Parents and Friends of Lesbians and Gays, and another excellent group for whole families to be involved, whether it's maybe you have someone who's a gay friend that just came out to you and you need some help with adjusting to that, or certainly for the parents, which are our best allies.
Oh, yeah.
That we love those PFLAG people. And so because the church was important to you, and what church is that?
Community Gospel.
Mm-hmm. And so you're still active in...
Yes.
And then Aja and I, we kind of went a different way with our church experience, at least.
Yes, we did.
I've been active for a long time with the women's group that meets at the First Unitarian Church on Sunday mornings. And it's not a church group, but it's certainly spiritual and religious in many ways. But every Sunday morning at 10:45 a.m., in the Sojourner Truth Room, women come together gay, straight, different ages, different ethnic backgrounds, and we discuss issues. Sometimes we talk about books and topics, and it can be one day we had a woman showing art and her approach to how she creates art. We had a wonderful discussion about the book A Thousand Splendid Sons.
Oh.
We talk about you know, sexuality and issues affecting us that way. It's just a very varied group. And there was one day that we had there where we had, I don't know, out of about 35 women, we had at least 10 that were from different countries than the United States. So that's an exciting group, and that's certainly a place that women can go to for support as they're coming out. So, Aja.
See, Aja, my dear. Yes, my dear.
You're adorable with the dimples and everything. You know, that song kind of is sticking in my mind about love comes in and then we come out. But sometimes it's not easy. And you were on with us, I guess, last month, and you read some poetry dealing with some heartbreak. And that's certainly another part of being a lesbian, is that when we meet someone, we think it's going to be forever.
Oh, yes.
And then... who knew 3 weeks was forever?
Oh, yeah.
So, you've been through a few relationships now at this, in your elder years of what, 25?
I'm a young thing, but, I've had my share of heartbreaks. But it's one of those things. You decide, am I going to just sit in one and listen to Melissa Etheridge and just cry? And or you just sort of take a breather and then you move on. I mean, I had that heartbreak around August, and it lasted maybe 2-3 weeks. And then maybe a month. I mean... Okay,
I had one that lasted 5 years.
But around September or so, I saw this just gorgeous creature at school. I auditioned for this play, and I had found the courage to walk up to her and ask her, so did you get a part? And asked her everything and talked to her a little bit. And then she starts talking to me, is that we see each other in the library. It's so cute, and in the hall. And finally, we just actually sit down and talk and realize we're both gay. And then
Didn't you suspect as much?
I honestly did, because she's so tall and butch and cute and just my type. And it was crazy. I never thought she
now,
would
Now, where are you
me.
At school?
University of Houston downtown.
Uh-huh. Yes. And were you in that play?
No, I didn't get a part, but she did. It
I
was
see.
Crazy.
And would that be the lovely Tia?
That is the lovely Tia.
Yeah, she is a very attractive woman.
Oh, God, I love
this
her to
pieces. This is true. I would have noticed her, too.
Oh, yeah.
You're into how many months now?
3 months.
3 months.
3 months today.
All right. Happy anniversary there. And so learning and growing and both going to school.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a organization on campus for GLBT?
They're trying to come up with one, but the students just, we have faculty support. We have a lot of gay professors at UHD, but I guess the students just really aren't looking to put that much work into it. So maybe I can try and get into that. Right now I'm working on the sociology club, which is, I love sociology, but that's something I try to find some time for, but right now there's not.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, Tia, what is your experience in the school environment?
With college?
Mm-hmm. has your being a lesbian had an impact on...
No, it hasn't.
Has it influenced courses you've taken or are interested in taking?
No, it... I've always had a passion for math, so it
wow.
hasn't really affected that.
She's smart, too.
Yeah. So, a passion for math.
Yes.
Now, how could we connect that to lesbians? It can be like Alice's Matrix on the L word.
Oh,
you can figure
goodness.
Out some formula that explains that. And Aja, has being a lesbian impacted what you are studying? Or, I mean, sociology certainly would be an area where the issues that face us as GLBT folks come into play?
Actually, it has. They're sort of getting the social work program together, and when they do, that'll be my major, my shift, and I plan on getting my master's in social work. And I hope to one day be the big head honcho at Hatch.
All right.
That's my
main goal.
That's my goal. That is my goal. So, Deb Murphy, when you step down, I hope to step up, and it's all because of her.
Yeah,
she is
Deb's
my role
great.
Model. She's amazing.
Well, we've been talking to Aja and Tia about lives of lesbians, and we hope that we have future conversations in the coming months on Queer Voices. If you're interested in taking part in the conversation, please contact me at Deborah@queervoices.org. And coming up next, what do we have, Glenn?
We have a piece of Janis Joplin music for you.
Woo! All right, Janis. Happy birthday, girl.
Just feels good enough to be young, and I'm all alone. This is Queer Voices.
You know, it seems like about 25 years ago, when we first started hearing about a mysterious disease that was affecting gay men in New York, Chicago, and San Francisco. Gay men, who, of course, who were sexually active. And this thing had no name, it had no cure, it had no treatment even. And it was all very mysterious. And deja vu, here comes something like that again.
Watch out, gay boys and girls. There's something else in our community affecting us.
I'm Glenn Holt, and Brian with a Y is here.
Brian Levinka, and we have a special guest, Paul Simmons. Both Paul and I are both involved with the Center for AIDS, which is a community resource which provides a one-stop shop for all things information-wise with the HIV/AIDS.
So, Paul, what is it? Is this AIDS 2? What's going on?
Well, the first thing I would say is I think what's in relation to your observation that when HIV came on the scene many years ago, we didn't even know what it was, and we didn't have any treatment for it. And that's actually what distinguishes HIV from the latest reports on what we call MRSA or Mrs. A or MRSA, which is that we do know what it is, and we do still and yet have treatment for it. I think probably what's generated most of the buzz lately was a report that came out in the Annals of Internal Medicine, which found, it reported two things. One, it reported there was a particular type or particular strain of MRSA, which they dubbed USA 300, that seemed more common among gay men in San Francisco than the general population in San Francisco. And two, it seemed to be sexually transmissible. But it's very important, I think, for people to know that staph, which is the bacteria that we're talking about here, is very common. It's actually responsible for a lot of skin infections, for example. It's usually treated, and that's the case even with staph infections that are drug resistant. It's not like we don't have any treatment options for it.
Well, that's what kind of surprised me, because I'm familiar with MSRA and people picking that up in hospital settings.
Right.
But this is kind of like, I understand it's actually in the same class of staph, but this one is even more antibiotic resistant, and there's something peculiar about this particular strain and gay men in New York, Chicago, and San Francisco.
Well, in the report in the Annals of Internal Medicine, they were looking particularly. This was basically a retrospective chart review, which they looked at people who presented over a 2-year period to 9 hospitals and 2 outpatient clinics in San Francisco, and that particular strain, again, which they dubbed USA 300, is still susceptible to a drug called Bactrim. And for that reason, the authors of the report encourage physicians to be careful, to be conservative with the use of Bactrim in gay men, because that may be the antibiotic that we will end up needing to use to treat this infection. But sometimes, depending on where the infection is, staph infections are not always treated with the antibiotics. Sometimes they're treated with what we call IND, which is incision and drainage. So if somebody has, for example, an abscess on the skin, you go to the doctor and they lance the abscess and drain it out that way. The reason that they think that it might be sexually transmissible is based on the anatomic location of the infections that they were finding in these men, which is that they were in the gay males in San Francisco. They were finding it on their buttocks, on their genitals, and on their perineum. And so that's what led them to conclude that this particular strain of MRSA is being sexually transmitted among gay men in San Francisco.
Well, I was reading something that there's also a tie to HIV positive men, that it seems to be especially prone to people that are HIV positive.
Well, actually, in this report, in the Annals report, they didn't report that.
Okay.
They actually reported that although male-to-male sexual activity was a risk factor, that risk factor was independent of HIV serostatus.
Yeah, I was reading the San Francisco Chronicle, article that it's been passing around the community a lot lately, and they had said that, and it's kind of a I don't know if it's sensational. It seems sensational because it does seem like this is the next wave of destruction coming towards the gay community, from what I've been reading, what people have been talking about, you know. And if that's not true, you know, I think we need to get the
I think it's important for people to know that that drug resistant bacteria have been a problem that the medical establishment has been aware of for a long time. And as you were mentioning earlier, it's been a problem for many years now in hospitals and in nursing homes. Mm-hmm. What we're seeing now is what's called community-acquired MRSA, which is that we're seeing it out in non-clinical settings now.
Which is scary.
Well, that's where the alarm comes from.
Yeah.
But it's not per se a new problem, and it's certainly nothing that started with the gay community. The origins, or at least one of the chief origins of this problem, is that for years in this country, we have overprescribed, we have made inappropriate use of antibiotics. So it's very common, for example, right, when we get a cold or the flu, we go to our doctors and we ask for antibiotics, right? And antibiotics have no effect on viral illnesses, but we go and ask for treatment and our doctors give it to us, and that's catching up to us now.
And of course the staph bacteria will evolve and adapt to the new conditions and the new things that are coming at it. So we're kind of we're conditioning our community to create this, I guess, super staph bug. I mean, I think that's where the alarm is coming from.
Well, that's the problem with the inappropriate use of antibiotics generally. That's what got us here. So when you use antibiotics inappropriately for a long enough amount of time and a large enough number of people, it's simple Darwinian selection theory, right? You will select out the bugs that are resistant to the treatment.
And I remember 20 years ago, standard treatment for somebody with fully developed HIV.
Well, back then it was GRID, right? The gay related immune deficiency.
Yeah, and they would put these people on Bactrim long term as a prophylactic.
Well, we still use Bactrim now among HIV-infected gay men as a prophylaxis. If they have a very low T-cell count, we'll give them Bactrim as prophylaxis against PCP, which is one of the potentially complicating factors in terms of trying to conserve the use of Bactrim in gay men for potential treatment of this particular MRSA strain, is that we do make prophylactic use of Bactrim.
Bactrim is like the final defense, the all-killer, the mighty, powerful antibiotic that we use at the lab. Is that what that is?
Well, I'm just relating to you what the authors of this report found, which was that none of the USA 300 isolates that they looked at were resistant to Bactrim. Oh. They were all susceptible to Bactrim.
Okay, so I'm a gay man. I'm sexually active. What are some of the signs? What should I be looking for if for the MRSA? What are some of the telltale signs for that?
Well, so staph, which is what we're talking about here, mm-hmm. we just happen to be talking about a drug-resistant strain of it. Staph is very commonly responsible for infections of the skin, so people do get abscesses from staph. And
I was reading an article, and one of the things they refer to are spider bites. Like, I have spider bites, like these little marks, like on your skin, and that's kind of, when you hear that, the first thing they say is, "Oh, is it a staph infection?" And I've had friends that had that, and it turned out to be the staph. So I don't know how she would describe the abscesses or the first signs of staph infection.
Well, I mean, it wouldn't necessarily be. I mean, sometimes, right, if you just cut your finger or you have any type of abrasion, and actually, that was one of the things that the authors of this report suggested, is that it might be sexual activity that results in abrasion of the skin.
Ah.
So usually, we know, right, when we have some type of infection in our skin, and if it's, and most of the time, right, it resolves on its own. We don't treat it even with antibiotics. But if you have a skin infection that's not going away, certainly you need to see your doctor about it.
And I was reading in another article that a great way to avoid this is to take a shower after sex, to soap up and kind of wash your skin.
Exactly, and the idea there is to reduce the colonization, to reduce the burden of bacteria that's on your skin. And it's also worth emphasizing, which we make a big deal of these days in the hospital, but it's worth emphasizing in the community too. So the best thing that any of us can do to not be spreading bugs around is to wash our hands.
If you're going to get dirty, you got to get clean afterwards.
Right.
Well, I was kind of thinking about that on the way over to the station this evening, and I was wondering, there's clean and then there's clean. If staff can be spread by casual contact, skin to skin, in other words,
right.
You know, without doing the nasty, then if I meet somebody, you know, go out on a conventional date, have dinner, maybe a little bit of holding hands, maybe a little bit of kissy face, do I need to run to the bathroom and scrub?
Yeah, so I think that's a really good point. So, you know, there is no, because staph is so common, there is no absolute foolproof, bulletproof way, right, to insulate yourself, to protect yourself from any exposure.
That's kind of scary.
Well, most of the time, right, exposure to staph, as I indicated earlier, most healthcare workers in the medical center are probably carriers. They're colonized with staph.
You probably got staph on you right now.
I haven't washed the shirt. No, I'm just kidding.
But most of the time, it's not a problem because if we're in general good health and if our skin is intact, it doesn't cause infections. But there is no foolproof way to insulate yourself from exposure to staph.
Now, we said a few moments ago that staph had, this MRSA had started out in the clinical, the hospital setting, and now we're seeing it kind of jumping in the community. What's causing that, and how is that happening?
That's a good question for an epidemiologist, but there are probably many mechanisms by that would account for that. So for one thing, right, patients leave hospitals with staph infections
and
come back into the community with them, and then they're carriers of those bugs, and they take them with them to the gym or to school or to wherever else. We've seen a number of reports about that recently, which is staph infection spreading among high school athletes. There were some cases of that you might have seen in the news up in Pennsylvania, where they had a really hard time trying to get rid of it there among the football players. And they think it actually, in that case, they think it came off the AstroTurf.
Wow.
Now, how long can staph survive on the surface? Is it forever? Is it days, weeks?
Well, bacteria are pretty hardy. In the hospitals, right, we usually use particular solutions to try to get it off the surfaces. You're probably not going to do that in your home. But if we're talking here about person-to-person transmission on a daily basis, the most effective thing that you can do is to wash your hands or to use one of those hand sanitizers.
Yes.
If you come over actually to the Center for AIDS, you'll see that we have those hand sanitizers everywhere, and we started that a few months ago when, you know, being conscious about the need of people who are coming into our facility to be able to have some quick way to clean their hands.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they do at the Downtown Y now, too.
Good.
Yeah. And then, of course, there was a report a couple of weeks ago about money and how people that handle money have, you know, higher risk of contracting what have you, bugs, staph.
Oh, I imagine so, because money is
handled so much.
It's printed on 100% rag, and so that's it's like linen, essentially.
I had heard it was 17 days that it could stay on there, and some people
would be surprised,
money.
Yeah. Nasty stuff. So where is all this going? Where is it heading?
Well, so the CDC has been telling physicians for years. I mean, the CDC started sounding the alarm about this long ago, that we need to stop with our inappropriate use of antibiotics. So one thing that, from a public health perspective, that all of us as members of the community can do is to stop putting pressure on our physicians to prescribe antibiotics for us when they're not indicated. So what happens, right, is that we come down with a cold or the flu, and we go to our doctor and we want him to treat us, and the doctor feels obliged to do that, and they give us antibiotics, and which have no effect at all on viral infections. And then in about 3 days, we feel better, which we were going to feel better in 3 days anyway. And so, but we make the association in our mind. And then, so when we're sick again, we go back and ask again. As members of the community, we need to quit doing that, and our doctors need to tell us no.
Yes.
And you also need to take antibiotics as prescribed.
Correct. You need to complete them. That's right.
Because some folks will take two or three and save the rest and figure that they can take them like aspirin one at a time when they've got something, and it just doesn't work that way. In fact, it's even worse than taking nothing at all, because you're breeding antibiotic-resistant bacteria.
That's exactly right.
Like the very thing that we've been talking about, which, does it have a name yet? The special MSRA thing?
This strain is the USA 300.
Right.
USA 300. I imagine we'll be hearing more about it. Did we forget to ask you about anything important that has to do with this?
I think you guys covered it.
We covered it. Wow.
So, okay, let's recap. Okay, we have this new staph bacteria that is mutated and is apparently drug resistant. Not drug resistant to everything, but it will mutate. So I guess if you're going to get dirty, be sure to get clean afterwards.
And it's not the end of the world. It's not as scary as AIDS was when AIDS was first coming.
Yeah. We know what this is, and we do have options for treating it.
Yes.
Okay. And so Brian with a Y.
Brian with a Y and Paul Simmons.
And how can people find more information about the Center for AIDS?
Oh, very good question. Center for AIDS has a website, centerforaids.org. And you can find out more information there.
And just Google it if you forget it.
Yes, and it's off of Hawthorne Street, 407 Hawthorne. It's tucked away in this little kind of storefront, which it's very kind of small looking, but you go inside and there's all this information, pamphlets, and they have seminars, and they have computers, and what else, Paul? I mean, it's just a wealth of information.
1407 Hawthorne, and it's in Montrose at the intersection of Hawthorne and Upon, about one block south of Westheimer.
And coming up next on Queer Voices, Jennifer Renee will talk with, and I'm not even going to try to pronounce this name, who is a professional counselor. You're listening to Queer Voices.
When we were young, we knew we were different. We didn't know how or why. And as we grew up, we found what was different was only our dreams and desires. But we learned the names that they had for us. We prayed they would never discover us. And as we waited silently, quietly, we learned them. We learned them silently.
So my dearest little sister, Sally Brown, it's Charlie here. A lot of things have happened since you skipped town. For one, I'm queer. For about a year, I know, of course, you might be less than psyched about the path I took. But I had to face the fact that I kinda liked how Linus looked before he booked. Cause Patty came out and left me shocked and confused. She shacked up with Marcy, who was clearly abused. And I picked up a needle that had just been used before. Now Lucy's playing hockey, her team just won the Stanley Cup. Schroeder dresses just like Beethoven did and ties her up. And she barks like a pup. And the hunt is on for Linus, but as you know, he's hard to catch. You see, he found that lots of interesting things could grow in the pumpkin patch. But the feds are no match. Cause he and the red-haired girl split the scene. The psilocybin sultan and the cannabis queen. And Franklin shot two back and now he ain't nowhere to be seen. Wah 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 wah. Break it down. Woodstock got eaten by the cat who lives next door. Snoopy got neutered and now he ain't Joe Cool no more. And he's still kinda sore. And Pigpen OD'd was just a matter of time. He couldn't keep a job on account of the grime. And he couldn't face the future of small town crime no more. So write us all a letter and tell us how the city is. Frida said she saw you, so tell me, how's the porno biz? My little sis, the porno biz, my little sis.
Thank you. Thank you.
That was Eric Schwartz and a song called Charlie Something from his year 2000 album Pleading the First. And before that, Scott Free, Not Good Enough, from his album The Living Dead from 1999. At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Walensky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
This way.
And here's the rest of the crew. I'm Jennifer Renee.
And Deborah Bell.
And we're here with Josue Maimi. Josue is a professional counselor and clear solutions counseling, providing clarity in challenging times, stress and pain management, building cooperative relationships, personal development, and parenting. Well, where do we start?
Anywhere you'd like, or Jennifer Renee?
Well, I guess the question that comes up first is there a real difference in parenting with same-sex couples and heterosexual couples?
In my experience, I think there is a little bit of a difference. In same-sex couples, you tend to have what's called more permissive parenting, in my experience, whereas in heterosexual couples, you tend to have more both authoritarian and permissive, as well as what's called authoritative parenting.
What's that mean?
Well, let me start at the top. There's actually four different types of parenting styles, Jennifer Renee. There's authoritarian parenting, which is kind of dictatorial parenting. There's permissive parenting, which is has lots of warmth and involvement, but not a lot of rules. There's also disengaged parenting, where there's not a lot of warmth or involvement, and there's not a lot of rules. And then there's authoritative parenting, which means that there's a lot of warmth and involvement, and there's a lot of rules. So in the gay and the lesbian community, what we see, what my experience that we see, is that we see a lot of kind of permissive parenting and authoritative parenting, and not as much of dictatorial or authoritarian parenting. Whereas in the straight community, we're seeing a lot of kind of a gamut of all of the above, but also a good predominant of permissive parenting.
Now, that's why my children turned out so well.
Oh, well, I was going to say, I think that my father fell into that first category.
That would be
the dictatorial
authoritarian.
I think a lot of people from our generation had that kind of parent.
Well, I guess that
at least one of them, and usually the father.
Well, that's
not to be stereotypical.
That's what I was going to say. It seems like that in the heterocup, don't you have a clear distinction between the male and female roles?
Yeah, I think there is. There's some, and that kind of falls into also the gay and lesbian community, because in the same sex community, they oftentimes they take on some of those same roles. So you see, let's back up a little bit. A lot of lesbian couples have children, and oftentimes the child is a product of a previous relationship. So what we see is that the custodial parent, as it were, is the person who kind of tends to be a permissive parent, whereas her partner is sometimes a bit disengaged, sometimes authoritative along with that, and sometimes somewhat authoritarian. But too often, there's not a shared process within which that they share the discipline of the household. Too often, it relies on the partner who have the children.
Well, I guess, and clear something up with me: authoritarian or authoritative. You give me a distinction
there. Yeah, that gets confusing sometimes, which is why I use the word dictatorial. Authoritarian, there is a lot of rules, a lot of structure. There's a lot of do it my way or the highway type of mentality. Whereas in authoritative parenting, there is a lot of engagement. The parent knows more about what's going on in the child. The parent listens to the child and receives feedback from the child. And there's kind of a joint decision-making process, but the parent still has ultimate control and final decision-making authority.
Is there one form better than another?
Sure. The authoritative is actually the better form, because in the authoritative process, the rules are clear and there's a reward that is given to the child when the rules are obeyed, whereas and also a punishment when the rules are not obeyed. But in the authoritarian, which is dictatorial, the rules are very strict, but there's not a lot of...
Because I said so, that's why.
That's exactly right. And there's not a reward that's equated with the rule.
Right. Okay?
And so the child does it out of threat and intimidation.
I think it's
and fear.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yeah. And don't do what I do. Do what I say do.
Yeah.
You heard
exactly.
That one? Yeah.
Yeah, Jennifer, you are a parent and you were the father.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do you feel about how you approach parenting?
Well, and the what we were talking about, I would say that I fall into that authoritative. Because of the way I grew up under that authoritarian dictatorship, I like to have just a few basic rules and then have total interaction, you know, based around, you know, caring and communication with just a few basic rules. And that's what I like. And that's what's been worked.
And that's usually what works. Let me clarify that everyone has a little bit of each one. And yet we all kind of predominate at one of the parenting styles over the others, even though we do include all four of them within our way of being a parent with our children.
Well, if we've been, let's say, well, in my case, so I had an authoritarian father,
mm-hmm.
you know, very dominant in the situation. Would I have turned out the way, you know, to be authoritative? Or is there a correlation between how you were reared and how you will rear your children?
Oh, sure. Oftentimes people usually do one of the two things. They either follow the pattern that they are most used to and they become the type of parent their parents were, or they do the exact opposite of what their parents do and kind of have a very reactionary process to their parenting process and implement a completely new and different one.
I have to, but you know, come to think of it, you say that and I've been thinking about that a second. When I was, you know, pretending I was a guy for those years, I was a little more authoritarian.
Sure.
I was the dictator, you know, the do it this way, which was very much my father.
Right.
But as I got in touch with my feminine side, I became more, you know, I moved off of that because it it wasn't what I was.
Right.
It was almost an act.
Yeah, generally speaking, men tend to be more authoritarian and mm-hmm. women tend to be more permissive. And they oftentimes get into a relationship with each other. And we see that in the gay and lesbian community as well, is that with the way gay and lesbians divide the gender roles can sometimes play into that stereotype as well.
Based on the way they were reared.
Based on the way they were reared, as well as based on how society kind of dictates.
If a couple comes together and there's already children involved, then there has to be some kind of negotiation about how parenting is to take place.
That's true.
And I think that's a little different than people who just get married and have a baby. But in my case, it was actually my spouse that taught me a lot about parenting. And
good.
He had a very authoritarian father, but a more permissive mother. But two of the things that were kind of bedrocks of our parenting was, there's consequences for your actions.
Sure.
And that if we tell you we're going to do something, that is going to take place.
Right.
You know, I mean, we didn't believe in hitting.
Right.
It's like children have to know you're going to follow through with what you say.
Absolutely.
Because you make a liar out of yourself and then they have you.
Absolutely.
Because it's usually, they always talk about the terrible twos, but it's usually around age three that they really start testing you every chance they get.
Sure.
Do they really mean what they say?
Mm-hmm.
And becoming aware of... To me, it was like I remembered what it was like to be a child. And as an adult...
It wasn't that long ago.
Yes, that's right. It was only, 56 years ago.
50 years ago.
But we know what it's like to have been children. Children don't know what it's like to be adults. So you can't approach children and with the expectation, when you say behave... They have to know what behave means.
Right. And what I do is I teach parents how to discipline their children effectively using basically written agreement, a written family contract that delineates the chore that's expected, the time when the chore needs to be completed, the reward that the child will receive when the chore is completed, or the consequence the child will receive if the reward
is not completed.
Oh, it's
super nanny. It's kind of the super nanny concept.
Yeah, she uses very, very basic parenting principles, and she does a very good job of it.
Yes.
I also think that it is much more difficult when you have a blended family to integrate parenting styles, because oftentimes when two people form a relationship, even whether it's whether they create children within the relationship or they bring children to the relationship, they often don't talk about how they're going to integrate their parenting styles. And one of the things that I do in my work as a licensed professional counselor is teach people how to create cooperative, loving, supportive relationships, both with the partners as well as with the children.
What is because that segues right into your relationship work also, but I got a question before we move on to something else. And then parenting, what kind of advice would you have to somebody that's out there thinking, whether they be a same-sex couple or even a heterosexual couple, when they're blending two families together, what should be, other than, you know, they love two people love each other, what about blending their families? What would be the best advice we can give them? Because I know there are a lot of people out there in our community, in the GLBT community, who are adopting and bringing children into the families.
I think creating having a discussion with their partner with respect to what is expected regarding the discipline of the household, and creating an agreement with each other about how you incorporate that kind of discipline. And I encourage people to create a written agreement where the children are expected to perform X chores for X rewards and X consequences, and where the parents, and here's a kicker, the parents also are expected to to perform chores of the household, making the bed, having dinner on time, picking up the children on time, et cetera, et cetera. And if the parents don't perform according to the agreement and make a mistake, then the children hold the parents accountable and to ensure that the parent provides some sort of punishment to themselves, as it were.
Oh, believe me, they'll find a way for payback.
They won't miss an opportunity to do that.
It's not about payback. It's about a structured process where the children can say to mom and dad, you know, you've made a mistake because you said a word that you shouldn't say, and so here's your consequence according to the family agreement that we have taken together. So to answer your question, it is creating that family joint structure where everyone knows what is expected and that there are rules and consequences for those behaviors. Yeah.
You use the term punishment, but I prefer the word discipline because there's a difference between punishment and discipline.
Right. That's an excellent. Thanks for calling me on that. I don't usually use the word punishment. With kids, like holding parents accountable, it makes a little bit more fun, if you will, for the kids to say, "You made a mistake, so here's the consequence for your mistake."
Well, Josue, I would love to have you on again, and maybe in February talk about some Valentine's relationship, kind of same-sex relationship issues.
That'd be great.
You're with Clear Solutions Consulting.
Yes, that's my business.
And you have a website. It has a great name.
I do. My website is menarestupidwomenarecrazy.com.
And you can go there to get more information about the workshops that are offered and information. Yeah. And you want to close out, Jennifer?
Well, I was going to say that yes, that was one of the things I was going to say. We've got to have you back because we barely touched on some of this. We've got how to handle stress.
Right.
And also how to really delineate between adults and children and how to have that special special quality?
How to create great relationships.
Great relationships.
And this is the one for next time, I think.
February,
we're
going to have you back.
And a friend, lover, employee, business partner, and 21 that you don't want.
That's it.
And that's Josue
Mimi.
Mimi.
That's right.
See? Thank you for being with us on Queer Voices.
Thank you, Josue.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
The road will end in Detroit. roads or even in Kathmandu. You could go all around the world trying to find something to do with your life, babe. When you only gotta do one thing well, you only gotta do one thing well to make it in this world, babe. You got a woman waiting for you there. All you ever gotta do is be a good man one time to one woman, and that'll be the end of the road, babe. I know you got more tears to shed, babe. So come on, come on, come on, come on.
The incredible Janis Joplin, and that song was Cry Baby. We'll have more from Janis coming up later in the program when Love Janis is talked about. We're going to have some people on from the Alley Theater, and they're going to be talking about a play that they're doing to benefit a sisters, and it's all about Janis Joplin. But coming up next, the rest from This Way Out.
This is Queer Voices.
We'll hear from a Canadian expert who's changing theater in America. But first, we'll take a closer look at a shocking situation in the land he left behind. Any man who has had sex with another man in the last 5 years can no longer donate his organs to Canada's transplant programs. As we reported last week, the new Health Canada regulation was established in December and apparently caught both the nation's medical community and LGBT rights groups by surprise. This Way Out correspondent Heather Kitching sought a second opinion about this ailing turn of events from Helen Kennedy, executive director of EGAL, the country's leading queer advocacy organization.
It was a shock, you know. I mean, we certainly hope that the government, before they enter into any of these types of regulations, that they would at least talk to the medical profession, you know, because when you get the head of the largest organ donation program in the country saying that he knew nothing about it and thinks that it's overkill, that's pretty serious.
Well, so in your calls to politicians and their staff, what have you been able to determine then about how this regulation came about?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I put a call into Tony Clement's office. He's the he's the minister, and I spoke with his chief of staff, William King, who was extremely rude on the phone, and then they had somebody else call me who was a bureaucrat, and basically they said that the regulation came in December. It was in the published in the Gazette, which is the federal government's document that lists all of the new legislation, and that the consultation was done by the Canadian Standards Association. So I asked for a list of who they consulted with. And of course it's not available. They told me that it was the Canadian Standards Association that made the recommendation.
Who is the Canadian Standards Association?
Well, I didn't know that the Canadian Standards Association had a medical department, because I only know them for safety standards around electronics and hard hats and that kind of thing.
Oh, okay.
What did they base this decision on? You know, if you're a smoker, you can donate your lungs. If you're a diabetic, you can donate your kidneys. You know, I just don't get the rationale here. And I think that the government has some explaining to do, and they certainly owe our community an apology.
I actually am aware of somebody very recently who underwent an organ transplant, and, you know, there was a huge search out to find friends and family who would be willing to, you know, get tested as potential donors because he didn't have a family member. And, I mean, this person was at death's door, and I really don't think he would have cared
if
the person donating was gay. In fact, it turned out the donor was a lesbian.
And where is the recipient's right to choose in this whole issue?
Mm-hmm.
You know, nobody is asking the recipient whether or not they want to receive the organ of a gay man, bisexual man. And from what I have been told from the medical profession, of every 100 donors, 7 will be rejected if this new regulation actually fades.
Mm-hmm.
So this is very, very serious. And, you know, obviously the most important thing is the safety of the system. Nobody wants to undermine the safety, but to throw a blanket rule applying to gay men, there are a lot of gay men in monogamous relationships. There are a lot of gay men who practice safe sex. There are no questions being asked on behavioral-based questions about safe sex practices.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, which almost indicates essentially Health Canada is saying that unprotected sex is okay, we'll take your organs.
The other thing that's astonishing is that given all of the dialogue that's happened in the past year around the blood donor regulations and the opportunities for improvement there, the idea that they would just turn around and do almost the exact same thing that Canadian Blood Services does.
We've also been informed that the bone marrow registry also discriminates against gay and bisexual men. And this is just a database. So you're not even allowed to put your name on the list if you're a gay man.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, these issues, it's timely. They need to be addressed. And I think it's the responsibility of the federal government to address it, like, imminently, because we cannot continue to perpetuate these stereotypes against our community. It's doing our community a huge disservice.
That was our correspondent Heather Kitching with Helen Kennedy, Executive Director of EGAL, Canada's leading LGBT advocacy group, on This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. Canadian-born Adam Bach is an openly gay Obie Award-winning playwright. His activist upbringing shines through in his latest play, The Shaker Chair, running through January 27th at the San Francisco Bay Area's Ashby Stage. Last time on This Way Out, Bach told our correspondent Brian Goble about the women whose work against animal cruelty and in support of the environment inspired his own ACT UP activism, how he likes to write unconventional, lifelike dialogue for out-of-the-mainstream characters, and why he doesn't have a theatrical axe to grind.
There's something so interesting about not telling people what to think, because in this world where we're always telling each other what to think, we're always fighting for the ability to have people do what we want. There's sort of an authoritarian quality to art sometimes. I'm like, now what would happen if I showed them and then really see whether or not the audience can sort of fight amongst themselves afterwards?
In this week's conclusion, Bach discusses his identity as a gay playwright, what he's learned by teaching his craft, and his process as a writer.
I wanted to ask you about being a gay playwright, which is something that, you know, some playwrights might say, oh, I'm a playwright who happens to be gay, but you, on the other hand, you like being called a gay playwright.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I do. Because I am. I think it actually really, it informs my writing. It places me in the world. There are a bunch of things that do. I'm Canadian, I'm gay, I'm white, I'm male, I'm 46, my experiences are my experiences. And there is something about being gay in this culture that affects how I see the world, how I'm treated, how I see other people being treated, who I identify with, and what things I might notice that I think straight people don't notice, to be honest. And some may not, but really, I'm very sensitive to bullying, I'm sensitive to cruelty, I'm sensitive to a lack of voice, I'm sensitive to whether or not you're allowed to say who you are to someone else. Are you afraid to be should you be allowed to be here? Stories like that become very sort of important to me, and I notice them. And also the whole idea of artifice and, you know, gay guys being good at designing or dressing or eating or what the sensual things, or is sex allowed, stuff like that. All that is really interesting to me. So I think it just keeps coming into my work. So the idea of not acknowledging that seems dishonest in a way.
You've taught playwriting, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what is that like for you teaching playwriting?
I love it. I love it. It's interesting. I think something that's really interesting about watching students these days is you notice people who want to be an actor or be a writer. They don't actually want to act. They don't want to write. And so that's something that I kept noticing in myself is like, do I want to be a writer or do I want to write? And I realized, oh, I love writing. I love the action of writing. And so that was something I watched. Some students wanted to actually be somewhere already, and some wanted to actually go on the journey. And I started learning a little bit more about myself and them. The other thing you learn about young writers, they take these enormous big jumps and leaps, and they're dangerous, and they take chances. And it's easy as I get older and sort of people tell me, oh, I love when you do that, to think, oh, I should just do that again. And the hard thing is to remember to stay fresh and to remember that I'm still learning all the time and that I never know what I'm doing. That I have some skills, but each time I write a new play, I have to learn how to write it because it's a different thing. You know, I try to give myself a different challenge in each play, do something different with language or do something different with staging or learn about event, what could be better, or how big could an event be, you know? How does time work on stage? So I spend my time trying to figure out, okay, how am I going to keep myself fresh? Because plays are really about surprise. They're about keeping people noticing that the world is awake or new. When you go and see a play, you have a whole audience. They're all watching this one play, but they are all making their own play up in their head. Afterwards, if you have a talk back, people are all, they've made these stories up about who this one is or what happens next. And that's why theater's kind of great, is it's one story, but it's all these stories at once. And the theater audience is at once a being, one group, and also a whole bunch of individuals all having their own experience at the same time. It's kind of a fascinating mix. Hmm. Different from movies, because in movies, the camera tells you where to look, and the voiceover tells you what to think, in a way. So it's very bound and very structured and can't change. It's unchangeable, that story. Whereas the theater has this fluidity to it that means that, oh, you can insert yourself there. You've seen a great show where suddenly an audience member laughs a lot and the play changes, you know?
Well, it's funny. You're learning about screenwriting right now, aren't you? In fact, you're doing a screenplay. Susan Laurie Parks has described writing a screenplay in a play this way. She says, it's like giving birth, and then with a play, you decide to keep the child, watch it grow. Right. But with screenplays, it's like giving a child up for adoption.
Yeah, heartbreaking. I haven't ever done one, so I'm like, I don't know. I'm going to see how it goes.
So what are you? You're writing a screenplay for Scott Rudin, right?
Well, I am, but I'm not, because we're actually not allowed to write right now because of the strike.
Right.
Yeah, because of the strike. So, of course, I'm still thinking. You can't stop thinking once you get started.
Yeah.
But mostly I'm getting ready. I have a new show in New York that will start rehearsing in February at Playwrights Horizons.
It's called Drunken City. What's that about?
The Drunken City is about... I always look for something to do with the play, and so I was thinking about how in a play the drunk guy tells the truth, usually. That's sort of a trope. So I thought, what if everyone was drunk? Maybe they'd all tell the truth. So I decided I'd have 5 drunk people and 1 sober person. So I thought, I wanted to do some drunk girls. And I was like, where are they drunk? And I saw these bachelorettes one day. So I was like, oh, I'm going to have 3 girls be bachelorettes at a bachelorette party out in the city late at night. And what happens is one of them kisses another guy. And so it's all about that same sort of moment of turning around. Like, what do you do if you've made a mistake? How do you get out of it? You know, your mom's already printed the invitations. People have said gifts. What do you do? You know, he has a lot of feelings, but she has to learn whether or not she's going to turn around and do something different. And then there are two boys in the background who fall in love at the same time. So it's a sort of a meditation, not even sort of a romp on marriage and who gets to fall in love and how you fall in love and do you truly fall in love? What does it mean? I'm fascinated by the moment when people wake up to their world. I'm really fascinated by how suddenly, if you realize something about yourself, let's say you realize, I just can't keep drinking, or I have to go on a diet, or I have to get a new job, or I have to get divorced. And then suddenly, after that decision or that awakening has happened, you can look around yourself and say, I can't live in the world that I used to live in, and yet you still have to get your way out of it, in a way. People want you to stay married. People want you to stay fat. They want you to stay drunk. So I'm really interested in that moment of when I or someone I know knows that they can't be the same person. How do you change? It's hard to change. I think it's hard to change because you're stuck in your life.
What do you do when you're writing a play and you just hit a block and you're like, okay, where is this going?
I have different techniques when I'm writing. I wrote this play called Swimming in the Shallows. And it started because I thought, oh, wouldn't it be interesting if a guy fell in love with a shark? And that was the start of it, but I didn't know anything beyond that. I was staying at my aunt and uncle's in Berkeley, and they lent me their house for a couple of months. So I was there, and they had piles and piles of National Geographics. So when I'd get lost, I'd stop and then I'd just read this National Geographic and then they'd be like, oh, something about a dump. So I'd throw the dump into the play and then I'd keep going and then, oh, I'll write something about Tibetan monks. Well, let's put that in the play. And just that sort of was very helpful. That was one of the ways I've done it. So I have these different sort of tricks to pull me back into a play.
Mm. Your plays have played in big cities like, you know, San Francisco, New York, Berkeley. I'm curious what the reaction is of smaller communities where your plays have had a run. What's been the reaction?
Usually, it's sort of, I've been lucky. You know, I've had it done in Utah. I've had plays done in small colleges in Maine. And people seem, I think they're befuddled at times, but mostly people, there's usually a group that gravitates to them, that wants to see something that isn't in the normal language of the world. And I get lucky that way. You know, I've been done a lot in little theaters. That's where something that's changing for me in the last couple of years is suddenly I'm getting into bigger theaters. Now we're talking 300-seat theaters instead of 100-seat theaters. And there's a different feeling to them. There's a different intimacy. And it's been interesting to see whether or not my work will translate bigger. I always thought it would, but people were like, no, this is a small story. Does it need a small space? I'm like, I don't know. We'll see.
Well, Adam Buck, thank you.
Well, you're extremely welcome.
That was This Way Out correspondent Brian Goble in conversation with award-winning gay playwright Adam Buck. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Rick Watts, Sherry Lund, Rex Walker with Bill Kelly, Heather Kitching, and Brian Goble contributed program material. Tim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Listen online to This Way Out exclusively at outinamerica.com. You can also click on the link at the top of our website, thiswayout.org. Most This Way Out operating expenses are funded by donations from our listeners. Thank you. Please log on to thiswayout.org to see how you can help keep this program on the air and choose from several special CD thank you gifts. You can also subscribe to CDs or cassettes of our weekly programs there. Email us at tworadio@aol.com or write to a post office box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For associate producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening on WGDR Plainfield, Vermont, KOOP Austin, Texas, Tasman FM Nubina, Tasmania, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. And we're all going to stay tuned.
This Way Out is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT. This Way Out is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to...
Yes. Oh, wow. Well, I was just so grooving there on Janis Joplin that, well, first of all, we have to say...
And I was trying to sing without...
Yeah, well, yeah, try is the operative word here. Janis Joplin would have been 65 years old on January 19th, and the city of Port Arthur, her hometown, has finally acknowledged her as a favorite daughter, and they're putting up a statue and kind of giving her her due after all these years. And this coincides with the current offering at the Alley Theater, which is called Love Janis. And we have Adriana Perez from the Alley to talk with us about this month's offering of Act Out, and also Liz McLean, who's the president of Assist Hers. And Assist Hers is the beneficiary of this Act Out event, which will be Thursday night. So welcome both of you, both returning guests to Queer Voices.
Thank you very much.
And of course, for me, Janis was such a huge part of my youth. Okay, I'm just going to say it, everybody. It's true. I got stoned with her once. So, you know.
Oh, my God.
I don't know if that's anything to be proud of or not. I just know that it happened. And she was an amazing woman. And I always like to think that she didn't purposely... kill herself, that she OD'd by mistake. Mm-hmm. But, of course, hers, like so many others before her and after her, dying at an early age. I think she was 28?
27.
Morrison, Hendrix, bunch of them, they all died at 27. She certainly is an icon in this region of the state, being from our right. neighbors to the east.
That's right.
And Jennifer,
just south of Beaumont.
Yes, Jennifer's neck of the woods, Port Arthur. And, you know, there's something in the water there, I'm just telling you, okay? I don't know, those refineries or whatever.
It
but
is. It is. There are a lot of teas come out of that Golden Triangle area. That's yeah, why they call it the triangle.
Yeah. That's
triangle.
Why.
That's it. You didn't know that, did you?
So let's talk a little bit about the play. Now, Adriana, I understand that it was written by her sister.
Yeah, the production is based on her letters that Janis Joplin wrote to her family, and also there's bits of interviews, bits of dialogue taken from actual interviews that she broadcast interviews that you know that were taken during her sort of rise to fame. And so there's, in the show, there is a speaking Janis and a singing Janis. So the speaking Janis sort of, you know, brings a story together of her sort of rise to fame and, you know, the struggle between being this sort of, you know, hometown girl that wanted, you know, that wanted acceptance by her family. And then this other, you know, rock star persona who was, you know, playing this part of being this, you know, sort of tortured soul. And, it's really great having both of those. Both of those Janises on stage together.
Now, I understand there's actually three different actors involved.
Yes, there is there's one actress, Marissa Ryan, who plays a speaking Janis, and she plays it every single night. And then there's two actresses that switch the roles of singing Janis. They alternate performances because the role is so demanding on their vocal cords.
Right. They must be tremendous talent.
Oh, they're fantastic. Both of them are so great. Katrina Chester and I blanked on her name. Mary Bridget Davies. They alternate the roles of the singing Janis.
And tell us a little bit of some of the promo material. It says it's her words, her story, her music.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit more about the play.
Well, it follows Janis leaving Port Arthur and arriving in San Francisco and discovering that there is life outside of Port Arthur.
We always expected as much.
Yes,
there is only life out.
Exactly.
Of
Exactly.
Of course, she kind of got a start and a following when she was in Austin. She went to UT, and at Treadgills is famous for giving her a break and first getting some attention.
Right. She does mention going to Austin and going to UT and then sort of going off to San Francisco. Yeah.
But she was an outsider,
she
a rebel.
Was.
She got treated badly by a number of people, kind of cruelly.
Especially in her hometown. Yeah.
Right, because she didn't fit in.
Mm-mm.
She wasn't the straight-haired, you know, perfect flip and makeup. She wasn't the Farrah Fawcett, which I think Farrah's time at UT coincided with Janis's.
Yes.
And then the Alley generously does this event every production, main stage production, which is Act Out. And tell us what Act Out is and the details about it, and then we'll go to Liz, and she can tell us about the sisters and why they're going to be the beneficiary and all the good things they do.
Excellent. Well, Act Out is our subscription group for the GLBT community, and we'll have a pre-show event that happens right before the show. We partner with another organization, and we have... You know, people. It's just a way to sort of mix and mingle and find out about other organizations around Houston that sort of benefit, you know, the GLBT community. We'll have the mixer between 6 and 7:30 at the theater on the fourth floor. You know, it's drinks, it's appetizers. We have giveaways. It's a good time.
It's really good appetizers.
Enough
to make your dinner for the evening, and then the lovely beverages. They do take tips for the bartenders and great DJ Michael Bell.
Yes, he's fantastic.
And now there's always a drink that is themed along with the play. And when the play was To Kill a Mockingbird, the drink was Tequila Mockingbird.
Exactly. We try to be creative.
Yeah.
Okay, what's this one?
It has to have Southern Comfort in it.
It does. And I, you know, it's called Peace of My Heart. I don't know. I feel like it could have been a little something.
I like it.
It's okay. I think we could have come up with a different name, a better name. But the more I see the show and the more I read about Janice, I start thinking, oh, we could have done something else. But that's great. I don't know exactly what the concoction is going to be, but I'm sure it'll be Southern Comfort. It's something.
Have something.
Something with a splash.
Because she was famous for her bottle of Southern Comfort on the stage.
Mm-hmm.
And is there a lot of excitement about this play?
There is. There's been really fantastic buzz, and we've had a lot of people coming in from Port Arthur. Laura Joplin, her sister, was actually in town a couple weeks ago, and she brought... she lives in California, but she had a group of her friends from Port Arthur come down to see the show, and it's been amazing seeing the crowds and the various age ranges of the crowd. We see a lot of parents bringing their teenage kids who have never heard of Janis Joplin, and it's great seeing her or hearing her music in a theater with a full band on stage, hearing her, you know, greatest like, music.
You mean somebody sang that before Melissa Etheridge?
Exactly.
Unbelievable.
And just seeing her on stage and hearing her music, it's a really, really great experience. And we've gotten some really fantastic, feedback from people saying, thank you so much. You know, she's from Texas. Everyone sort of feels like she's, part of them. And it's been great.
Mm-hmm. And of course, Kris Kristofferson wrote Me and Bobby mm-hmm. McGee. He actually has a version of that as well. And I'll never forget her singing that, with a small group of people. Mm-hmm. She would come into Houston and party. And so, back in the day.
Considering the Port Arthur, I can understand that.
Back in the day, as we say.
That's right.
And being one of the kids that hung out in Montrose and...
I got it.
Yeah.
Got it. What about his sisters?
Yeah. Well, what about his sisters? They benefit from the sale of the tickets for the Act Out. And Sisters is one of our wonderful community organizations. Liz McLean is the president. So tell us what all the Sisters is about, because we need to remind people.
I'll do that. I first want to thank the Alley again, because the January 24th Act Out event is a wonderful way for us to become more visible to the greater Houston community, not just the Montrose community, GLBT community. So we're very positive about that. And we're really jazzed because Janice is just perfect for this. Since the play celebrates an independent, creative Texas woman, we feel that's a real role model for our community and our organization, both our clients and our volunteers. And I guess I'm prejudiced in this sense, since I grew up in Austin and went to UT and was just a few years behind Miss Janice, and also lived at Threadgill. So there's all these wonderful connections in there. So we're going into our 12th year as an organization. We have about 25 clients at this point, with five more in the process of becoming clients. We've grown really quickly. We're up from 14 clients and 11 teams in just 5 years. So we've about doubled our size. We now have
have a waiting list, right?
We have had a waiting list, and we will continue to have a waiting list.
And explain what you have to do in order to be a client. What's the situation? Who
basically
is the population that a sister serves?
We serve the lesbian community, and what you basically need to do is contact us at our website, assisthers, assisthers.org, or at 713-521-4628, and say that you would be, or you're interested in being taken a look at. We'll send out client services folks, our assessment people, and we'll make the determination on whether you qualify for our assistance. We have no paid staff, no government underwriting. This is about 150 volunteers who make up over 20 caregiving teams. We do all kinds of things. We run errands, perform household and yard-related chores, take people to the doctors. We also provide monthly food cards and taxi vouchers for medical appointments, case management resources, and a support group. So there are a number of things we do for the larger lesbian community in the Houston area.
And what kind of training do volunteers get in order to be able to perform these tasks?
They get an initial orientation, 2 to 4 hours in that, and they also then come to our second Saturday event, which occurs every second Saturday every month at Bering, very kindly. And we do a lot of reinforcement. We have an in-service that's provided that gives them a lot of extra information. Plus, we have a lot of fun. We have decadent dessert, softball tournaments, all kinds of things, right, fundraisings along those lines. But we have a continuous education. In fact, this weekend we're going to be doing team lead training, So there's an effort to make sure that we don't just stay in a little cycle of training one time, we come back.
Right. So, but it's not medical services. You don't have to give people shots. You don't have to do things that medical personnel, nor should you be doing that.
In fact, we have a standard against that.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right.
You're just the caregivers.
Right. And also relief for the partner or other care providers for a person if they're in a chronically ill situation. They may have several people that help them out, but those people need a break every now and then.
Yeah, this way we can give people relief in this circumstance. We've had quick response teams for people who had immediate problems. We tried to look at every possible potential option that comes our way and make a fit.
And if someone is interested in volunteering, now do you have to be a lesbian to volunteer?
No, we take everybody. Come on down. We in fact have a MySpace site now, MySpace/Assisters. We suggest you go there. Our website or the phone number again, 713-521-4628. Be glad to have anybody come by, fill out a form, and come join us. It'd be terrific.
Mm-hmm. Now, just because it's sometimes hard to hear it, and even not just on the radio, it's two words that are together.
Right.
Assist HERS. It's a very clever one of the
one more
great part of the great work of Tori
Williams.
Yeah. Williams, one of the efforts that she helped create over the years. And people can meet other members of the sisters at the event on Thursday, because I already know several of them have said they'll be there. And
I know we'll have at least a gang of 14 of us there, plus more, many more. So
we do have some ticket giveaways.
Cool.
And I have a question. I have two questions. Yes, we do. There's someone telling me no, but yes, we do. You can answer either question. What is the name of the club?
There's not going to be anybody here to answer the phone.
Yes, the club restaurant that is in Austin, where Janice got her first break. And the other question is, who wrote the song Me and Bobby McGee? And the number is 713-526-5738 if you'd like to win a pair of tickets to see Love Janice this Thursday night as part of the Allie's Act Out series. Adriana, give us the information on how they can get the tickets.
You can purchase tickets at www.alleytheater.org. And mention that you mention that you want to come to the Act Out event on Thursday, or you can go onto the website. I just mentioned the website, didn't I? Yes, alleytheater.org, and you can enter your promo code Act Out, and that way you'll be able to get your information regarding the event. So you can call the box office at 713-220-5700 or website at alleytheater.org.
Thank you so much for being with us on Queer Voices. Is there anything that we didn't ask that you want to make sure people know about?
Just come out. We think we'll have a great time.
Come to an event on Thursday. It'll be fun.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And coming up next week on Queer Voices, Jennifer Renee will be talking about the upcoming gender performance at Numbers on February 2nd called Cirque du Soleil. Bears and unicorns and unicycles, etc. will abound, with Jessica Maya as Pedro Atzi. I don't know what that's all about, but it ought to be interesting. And then also we have J.D. Doyle's Queer Music Heritage in the second hour, and J.D. will be presenting his Best of 2007 show. You have been listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Valensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, Jennifer Renee, Greg Chapman, and Jack Valensky. Be sure to listen every Saturday night, Sunday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper,
It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
Tune in to Open Journal on February 1st for a special program kicking off Black History Month. It will be hosted by Rick Mitchell and feature Dr. Fred McGee from Austin, Dr. Greg Maddox from Texas Southern University, and Naomi Carrier from Houston Street James School, discussing the issues of how African and African American history is taught in America and how the iFest curriculum guide addresses some of those issues. Each year, the Houston International Festival publishes and distributes a teacher's curriculum guide based on the honored nation or theme of that year's festival. The 2008 theme is Out of Africa, the Three Journeys. The first journey represents the original human migration out of Africa. The second involves the slave trade. The third concerns issues of globalization and the ongoing relationship between Africa and the Americas. The guide is distributed in book and CD form to all HASD and Region 4 schools. Again, that's Open Journal on Friday, February 1st at noon, right here on KPFT Houston.
Thoughts and reality change. There is nothing permanent but impermanence. Is Houston amongst the things that are silently changing? And is it destined to be the next spiritual epicenter of America? Listen to New Vibes, Mind, Body, Spirit, Open Journal, January 25 at noon to find out the subtle spiritual changes, the hidden jewels, and the changes occurring in Houston that all point to the inevitability of these changes and growth towards the path of Houston's voyage towards spiritual leadership. Based on both ancient wisdoms and modern approaches to these ancient wisdoms, I'm Patricia Pellicciotti of New Vibes, inviting you to receive nothing but good vibrations and to participate in the grassroots efforts of change in Houston that will become, and hear the facts regarding them, the next spiritual epicenter of America.
KPFT, Houston.
On March 8th, the ACLU of Texas is celebrating 70 years in Texas. The ACLU of Texas began with the pecan sheller strike in San Antonio in the late 1930s. The pecan shellers, predominantly Latina, had their pay cut. In reaction, they went on strike. They were led by 24-year-old Emma Tanayuka. The strike resulted in violence and a call by San Antonio Congressman Maury Maverick Sr. for the founding of the Civil Liberties Union of Texas. The event will take place at the Hyatt Regency Riverwalk. The ACLU will host a day-long conference focusing on the future of Texas.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.